I'm really delighted to welcome Cliff. Thank you very much for coming. Cliff was born in Birmingham, grew up in Kidderminster in Birmingham, and now lives in Gloucester, so wonderfully local to us, which is great. You left school at 16 and did a variety of jobs before returning to full-time education. Cliff has been a teacher and is currently a tutor for the Arvon Foundation and a Royal Literary Fund Fellow at Aston University. So I'd now like to hand over to Cliff.
Thanks for turning up. Chloe said she'd emailed for 2,000 people, so I was expecting.
I do think we do have some emails of people who are in America and places, so I suppose it was a long shot.
They weren't going to jet over. Right. Okay, I'll read some from Henry Slott's dot off. This is Clara, which starts in a classroom, as so many films do. I don't think there's anything obscure in this poem, apart from Villa Park. Villa Park?
Oh, yes.
You know about Villa Park? Centre of the known universe. Yeah. Unless you support West Ham.
You sold your colours.
That's right. Clara. He stands at the classroom door, rubbing together big hands. Poetry tomorrow, Clara. Poetry. Clara has other plans. She is seeing Andy, who's doing sociology and English at the Tech. Saturday, he took her on the terraces of Villa Park. She stood behind him, warming her hands in the back pockets of his Wranglers. Later, they shared a hot dog at the fair, started at either end, met in the middle. On the bus home, they sat upstairs at the back, smoking French cigarettes. He cupped both hands around her goldfish in its plastic bag. She peeped through the cracks, wanting it to sleep in the pink dark. Tomorrow it's his place. His mum's out for the day. He'll read her his essay on the crisis of identity of the post-industrial British working class. They'll lie together in front of the electric fire, listening to Van Morrison. Later, upstairs, they'll run a warm bath. Set the goldfish free. I feel quite home in Ledbury because I brought up in Kidderminster, which is not far away. I used to come over here when I was in my teens. And Kidderminster is a very different place from Ledbury. This poem starts off one night walking back from some event in the town centre, and so two lads tried to steal the hat I was wearing, which was my dad's strawberry, and I wouldn't give it them. And ends up, gets hijacked by a metaphor. It refers to two poetry pieces of music. One is Stravinsky's Soldier's Tale, which is his version of the Faust story, in which a soldier is ignores the advice of a character called the Silent Princess and trades his fiddle and his immortal soul for the Book of Knowledge, but he can't read. Should have listened to the Silent Princess. And the other piece of music I refer to is John Cage's 4 minutes 33 seconds, his silent piece, which he once said took him 4 years to write. Tonight in Kidderminster begins under streetlights, two of them chewing gum with their mouths open, thumbs in their pockets and feet tapping. The tall one sees me first, sees the hat. This hat goes with the hair, the desert boots and jeans, the shabby raincoat and ripped gold lining. It goes with the sky before rain and just after, and with one unforgettable night on Kinver Edge, eight of us in the back of a minivan. This hat is my dad's, and I wouldn't sell it for £50. They chase me for it and lost, turn left into another story, fiction, trembling hands full of someone's prescription, eyes that are needles sewing the hem on tomorrow's shroud. Or gramophone needles. The first record is Stravinsky's Soldier's Tale. The soldier has forgotten the silent princess. He hums along to the drum solo and dreams only of the fiddle he traded for a book. A book he could not read. Words he can't remember. Next it's 4 minutes 33 seconds, live in Woodstock, New York, 1952. The duff tape missed the rain on the roof, traffic in the distance, people angrily rising and leaving, but detected the silence. 4 years in the making. Listen. Tonight in Kidderminster, our audience is the night. The agitated stars cough less and less discreetly. By the third movement, programmes flutter like moths. Barely visible to the naked eye, the devil jigs to the soldier's fiddle, while the silent princess wheels the plough across the night sky, and the pole star stays where it is. It's a short one. I'll read this one. I don't need to read. This is set in the middle of winter when a young man is meeting his girlfriend's family for the very first time, and pet budgies flying around the room, and there's a big open fire. And this is what happened. This happened to a friend of mine. Meeting the family. He says something witty about the budgie. They smile. He's smiling so much that his cheeks ache. He crosses his legs and kicks the budgie into the fire. She screams. It is not a good start to the evening. It's not easy to make conversation with charred feathers floating about the room.
And that's real.
Sorry?
That was real.
That's true. I'll read some from Frank Freeman's Downton School. I wrote a series of poems which had two voices in, and one of the voices, I made up most of the detail, but the atmosphere I got from a French-Canadian film called Jesus of Montreal, in which a young man who plays the part of Jesus in a mystery play actually dies from the experience because he's so traumatised by it, and gains a kind of immortality where his organs are donated to science after his death. It's a very happy little story. And the other voice is kind of me, age 21, living in Swansea. I went to university. On the third day, for my 21st, we did the Mumbles Run, a pint in every pub on the Mumbles Road between Blackpill and Limeslade. Brained is the local brew. It's easy to see why. The limp evening drizzled over the city, sodden paper settled on the pavements. No one was pretending apart from the statues, and we didn't recognise the statues. Graham showed me on an earlier occasion the art of drinking beer. You don't swallow so much, you pour it down. If you have to swallow, take really big gulps, much bigger than you think. The station was nearly empty. The last train had left, and he was on the platform opposite, crouched over but unable to call out, hesitating before that moment. Don't worry, you won't drown. I could down a pint in 9 gulps, Graham in 5, and Tony in 1. His heart beating inside a stranger's chest, his eyes gazing out from a stranger's face. It was probably too late to save him. A dog barked in the distance. Some people came late and joined us halfway. I didn't realise you could do that. It's cheating, isn't it, really? Chez Marianne. Set in the next apartment, the children are quieter. Soon they'll run a bath, and one of them will lie in it moving. She comes out of the bathroom, her hair standing, shaped to a point like an alien. Are you cold? No, I'm airing the towels. That's a good idea. Here, which of these switches the light on? The sun comes out as if by invitation. Step any further back and you'll fall off the edge. I've seen this before in Spain. Her lips aren't moving, but the words keep coming. Outside Chez Marianne on Rue de Rosier, a beggar begs from a big man with loose hair and fly undone, who smiles like Tommy Cooper, then walks in the opposite direction. And suddenly, down the side road, the full moon. The traffic's too busy to stand here and admire it, though on the Seine, it's reflecting in the water as well. So they have two moons to admire, not one. And from Jam. My brother took that photo on the front. It's a picture of a sun with a plane flying in front of it. It's really hard to get a good image like that, so he was really chuffed when he got it. He's a solar astronomer, among other things, and he calls it his book. Our book. A little bit annoying. But it's a good photo, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's a good
photo. I thought it was the moon.
Yeah. I know, yeah. The sunspots, just to know that little detail. In fact, I wasn't going to read this, but there's one poem in it that refers to the sun by sheer coincidence. And also, Leslie was talking about milk earlier, and this poem mentions milk. So, is that okay?
Yes. That's a nice poem.
It's called "You Always Thought You Liked Dogs, But Your Neighbours." Appears to be running at you and has just smashed through the French windows, knocking over the milk in the Marilyn Monroe glass that you brought back from Slovakia. The glass is just about to hit the tiles, and the milk is like a photograph of milk liberated from the glass, or a milk sculpture. And in the background, the teeth and slavering mouth of next door's dog, an elaborately crossbred bitch, well over £1,000 and worth it for its sociable temperament and clean habits. Bearing down remarkably quickly, in spite of its replacement hip, the sun behind it through the broken windows, rising ruthlessly in a clear sky, and a jet trail refusing to vanish, making the most of it. We were in St Ives week before last, so I'll read a Cornwall poem called, appropriately enough, "The End of the World Again." Dolphin Street, Port Isaac, it's raining. Crab sandwiches and a pot of tea in the cafe on the hill. Now we're back in the cottage under a duvet on the sofa. I'm reading exit music from the shelf I always bang my head on coming down the stairs. We're sharing a box of Maltesers and wondering why we have to drive all the way to Cornwall and rent a cottage in order to live like kings. Last night, I dreamed it was the end of the world again, and I was about to give birth from my right leg. The holy woman said, "I want you to think of three things: your mother, a potato, and disappointment." I couldn't think of a single disappointment. Went and stayed with some friends in Switzerland, and they were musicians, and he was also the head teacher of the school, and he said that he could always work out the kids who were going to be good at school because they were the ones that went to bed early. They didn't see them out on the street, and they would remember everything in the classroom. They really didn't remember anything. And I was reading a pair of very tatty, like Converse things, and borrowed a pair of shoes for me from the local postman. You know they're going to be good shoes. We talked about personal early, weren't we, Philip?
Yeah.
There is a theme going on here. Old St. Johann. The children hide in the tree. They whisper and laugh. The branches move. These are the mountains. The trees are the mountains. The rocks. You walk and forget that you walk. The child climbs out of the hedge, clutching a fistful of wheat, its roots thick with soil. Chew the husks, taste the sweetness. The cat sits on the cooker, gazes out on the valley, closes her eyes and opens them. You see only half of the moon, and mist comes out of the ground. The cherries are finished on the tree, the red currants ripe on the bush. We sleep at the top of the house, in the room full of musical instruments. The music enters our dreams and leaves by the gate, leaving it open. This, I decide, is paradise, where they lend you their shoes and they fit. It's easy to laugh, and the children walk forever, sleep through the night in the valley of stars, wake with the light, and remember. Life Studies, a title I stole from Robert Lowell. And the poem refers to the rivalry between Robert Lowell and Frank O'Hara, two very important, obviously, American poets, for anyone that might not know. The great rivalry between them, they turned up for the same poetry reading, and Frank O'Hara introduced a poem by saying, I wrote this on the way over, and on the Staten Ferry, Robert Lowell was really fed up, because none of these were written that quickly. Yeah. So it borrows a title from Robert Lowell, but actually it owes more to Frank O'Hara in the way it's written. Life Studies. I meet Tom for super sandwiches at Euston. It still looks good, his 20 quid haircut. Then I take the Hammersmith and seek the Gold Hawk Road. Someone said the best moments are moments of realisation. On the Bumping Underground, I read life studies for the first time since the 70s in my old Faber-selected 45p, signed and dated with my youngest signature. O'Hara wasn't keen on Lowell, and I love O'Hara, but there's something in Lowell that I recognise. I recognise his underground stations, their names, though I've never been here before. That song by Jerry Rafferty with the unforgettable sax. I sit next to a girl who smells like a bag of crisps, or maybe I can just smell crisps. It's not a girl, I realise, it's a boy with dreadlocks eating a pear at Paddington, in a pink and white scarf, camel-coloured coat, pinstripe trousers, red and black boots. Baker Street. You know Baker Street, don't you? Yeah. Can anyone hum the sax solo? That's great. I hope the mic picks that up. The next poem is also the first poem in Frank Freeman's Dancing School. It's in both collections because it occurs in this book because it became the first in a sequence. I didn't realise it was going to be when I first wrote it. It's called Lighthouse. I'm never sure what to say about this poem when I introduce it. I sometimes say it's a love poem, but I'm not sure that it is. Lighthouse. The lighthouse flickers at the end of the pier. We watch it in our red pyjamas. Actually, neither of us are wearing red pyjamas. You're wearing my blue shirt. The lighthouse flickers at the end of the pier. It's the only thing we can be sure of. Everything's uncertain since you've set alight my record collection. I'm trying to work out an appropriate reaction, rearranging things in my head to eliminate all memory of the record collection. The lighthouse flickers on and off. Actually, it doesn't, you point out, it just appears to. You look amazing in my blue shirt. I haven't words to describe how good you look in the light from the lighthouse. Now you're here. Now you're not. Maybe I should burn something of yours, you suggest. Your voice leaves me in the dark. It doesn't sound like you when I can't see you. And this is called Gate. A gate halfway up the garden, a wrought iron gate that she once painted cream so that she could see it. You step around the gate, if truth were told. There's plenty of room on either side, but always we walk through the gate, careful not to latch it. Her fingers, at 88, can no longer manage the latch, and her legs can barely manage the step. Mind you shut the gate, she says, as she always says, on the way back down, turning round, just to make sure. Pull it to, keep out the draft. That's it. Middle age is a walk through the woods without your parents. Your children have run ahead. The sun is out. There are so many trees. Snooker table. How big is a snooker table? It's bigger than this room, isn't it, really? Full-size snooker table, isn't it? A huge, aren't they? No, they're not, but they're big, aren't they? They're big, aren't they? And the balls are amazing, aren't they? Like half the size of tennis balls. Right, fantastic, beautiful. This one is called... There's a full-size snooker table at the YMCA furniture shop. I stand there for ages, looking at it, thinking, how wonderful to have one. To have the room for a full-size snooker table, the colours of the balls against the green, the way they snap, the sound when you pop one, the paraphernalia of scoring, the everlasting cube of blue chalk. I hand over a wad of notes, and a couple of lads help me manoeuvre the snooker table out of the door. They watch me ease it onto my shoulder and head off home in the rain, pockets bulging with snooker balls, the cues strapped to my back like a quiver of arrows.
What a dream.
It's true. I wrote a series of poems about someone that lived at the bottom of the pond. And there are poems in every collection about this character. His name's Kevin, and as it would be, and he lives in a pond, and he has to learn how to breathe out of water because he falls in love with a girl who doesn't live at the bottom of the pond. She's like us, you know, she lives in air. And he moves in with her. And this is from a series of poems, incomplete, unfinished, in which he's moved in with her. And he has to do certain things to keep going. Like, he's trying to work out how to breathe above water. And so, and he spends a lot of time in the bath, you know, as you would. So it's from River Sound, in which Kevin learns to breathe out of water. I lie in the bath, submerge, her key in the door. I'm in the bath. You're always in the bath. I can't help it. I know. She adds more hot, takes off her clothes, climbs in. She towel dries her hair as I climb out, put on my shirt. You're still wet. I know. The shirt clings to my back, jeans to my legs. Water drips down my face, down my neck. He sings in the bath, stares into space and sees water. We have wet towels on radiators, water boiling in the kitchen. Condensation streams down the walls. I wake in the night, hear him in the bath. I can't build a fire while he sits in the corner, feet in the bowl, shaking. I have to watch him in the rain. He take off his clothes if I let him. Street noise, people, try not to catch their eye. Remember not to stare. Do like she says, hands in pockets, eyes on pavement. Sudden rain, delicious wet. Rain on pavement, rain on cars, streaming down the gutter, gurgling in the drain. I stand on a corner, eyes closed, rain on my face. She's here. She takes my arm, pulls me along, talks, keeps me awake so that people don't see, people don't guess. Hair soaked, clothes, no scarf, no hat. Let it pour, soak through. Don't wring me out. Let me stay wet so that when you touch me, water comes. Rain makes me happy and floods are a reminder. Rainbow, moonlight, on water, moon glow. And finally, this one's called Travis Perkins. Do you have one in Ledbury?
Yeah,
they're everywhere, aren't they? You all know Travis Perkins, don't you? Yeah. Funny enough, I did this poetry reading in Nottingham and someone shook his head. And his partner, she started to laugh because she did all the doing herself. She knew where Travis Perkins was. Me and Phil are at Travis Perkins, picking up some breathable membrane. Ted is sorting us out. There's my mate down that hole, Ted says. The hole is in the car park by a pile of rubble and a mini digger. Ted's mate, in high vis, hard hat, wraparound sunglasses, is up to his chest, shoveling in the sunshine, as if he's looking for something. He's a big bloke, he can barely fit. In fact, the hole is just the right size. He sees us. All right, he says, and waves. Thank you.
Thank you. That was great. So, we had agreed how we were going to do this, and I'm just going to do something a bit different, I think. Because having heard you read those poems, I just really feel like we should just dive in and start talking about them, and then I'll ask you about your childhood afterwards,
okay,
if that's okay. So, because I was thinking, now there's a great poem in here, Spade Bucket Apple, and... do you want to just read that very quickly?
Sure.
And then, because I think it will introduce what I'm going to...
Spade Bucket Apple. No longer one to call a spade, he calls it bucket or apple. It's exhausting. Like mistaking a pig for a favourite cow, then trying to milk it in a ruined building.
So I wanted to pick that out because one of the questions I wanted to ask you was about a sort of tension in the book between, I think, maybe different types of poems, sort of poems that feel almost like they're sort of resisting any metaphor, they're sort of finding, like you said, the words you used when you introduced one poem was that the metaphor hijacked the poem, almost like it's a kind of, and then these poems which are like almost completely sort of like a whole metaphor, completely surreal, or these wonderful flighty poems that go off in unexpected directions. So I just wanted to ask you about that, about do you think there's a tension with you, or I mean that idea of do you think you prune quite heavily away from metaphors in your poems, or are you aware they could take over too much, or is there something going on, or?
There's a lot of tension in me. For a start, get that away. I don't think about metaphor when I'm writing, but I'm aware that a lot of my poems can be seen, as you say, as completely metaphor. I quite like the flatness of language,
right,
where you're never quite sure whether you're in that world or not, which kind of resists that kind of interpretation and yet welcomes it at the same time.
Yeah.
So some of the poems which appear to be very, very flat, and so on, aren't necessarily so. I mentioned Frank O'Hara there, and his poems are very flat, and there's that kind of style of writing which is I find that very attractive.
And what's it trying to do then? Is that partly to enable a story to be told better, or is it to enable us to place our own things into it, or what? What is it?
I think it's to get the poem written, really. That's what it is.
Do they come out like that then? Or
yeah,
you do,
yeah, they
so
do.
Oh, is that because
they come out. I do work on my poems a lot.
Right.
Quite exhaustively. But some of them come out much as they are.
Oh,
like that.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting hearing people say things about the poems, because they say things that I hadn't anticipated, which is the whole point of it. That question, that thing that you said a minute ago. Lee Harwood once said that a poem is like a telegram torn in half, and half of it is given to the reader. You just got that. Oh, that's great. And really.
Yeah.
And I like poems which aren't worked out, where I've got things to do when I read them.
Yeah.
So for me, I try to write work which I would find interesting. I think that's the least I can do. So hopefully that will be the case, that it would enable the reader to do some work. I wouldn't like a poem that was kind of clipped shut at the end, like a poem which is open.
Yeah, that's, I mean, you do that quite dramatically in a couple of your poems. There's one poem where it sort of ends and you almost think it hasn't ended, where it's, I think it's some terrible disaster's about to happen. I can't remember, but so that idea of an ending that leaves you hanging is there as well, isn't it? So when you write a poem, what's the process you go through then? Do you write a lot, or do you think a lot in your head? Do you walk as you write, or?
They're all different.
Are they?
I tend to write fast, and I tend to do it when I should be doing something else. Because I was a teacher for a long time. I taught for, 29 years. And you don't have time, do you, Philip, when you teach? You do anything else. You're writing, your life is consumed. And we had three children. And that was a full-time job.
Yeah.
And the rest of it. So I was always doing it when I should be doing something else, really. And I became a so-called full-time writer about 5 years ago. We moved away from the Northwest and moved down to Cheltenham, where we live now. And suddenly had time, and I didn't know how to do it. How do you sit down and write? I work at the Arvin Foundation with a lot of novelists who have a routine, but I haven't got that kind of routine. So the poems come in different ways. Sometimes they come when I'm walking around, usually when I haven't got a notebook with me, actually.
Oh yeah,
that's almost guaranteed. But when I'm travelling or doing something, or someone says something, it can be anything.
Yeah. So do you think then that more time has been good for your poetry in the end, or do you feel sometimes that you need to go and get a job again?
Oh, I do a lot of work anyway.
Oh, okay, because of your teaching, but teaching poetry, is that the key?
Yeah. I do, of course, the Arvin Foundation, some work in schools, and I've got that fellowship, Royal Literary Fund Fellowship. So I spend a lot of time doing things with language outside the home.
Yeah.
So really, I don't see myself as a full-time writer, right. Even though technically, I am.
Yeah. So what would you say then has sort of been the best things in your life for poetry, I suppose? So, I mean, from top, what brought you to poetry first off, and then has there anything that you think has been really good for you as a poet that's kind of really...
Yeah, I was an English teacher, and I was getting the kids to write poems, and they're doing really well, but I was thinking to myself, this is fake, I'm doing something I don't do, and I always wanted to write. And as you said earlier, I left school at 16, I had a disastrous time at school, I hated school, I was caned all the time. I was naughty, one of those disaffected kids. And I was an English teacher, and the kids were writing, I thought, I want to start writing, I always wanted to write. So I started to do workshops, and one workshop with a poet called Pete Morgan started me writing, and that's how I started writing. And about the things that were good for me, that was in the 80s. The thing that was good for me was coming across Ian Macmillan and the what was called the Huddersfield poetry scene at that time. And there was a kind of very lively poetry scene where kind of working class experience was accommodated.
Right.
Yeah. And it was the influences were people like Frank O'Hara, the American poetry was very... there in the influence. And it was that ability to write about working class experience, because when I started writing I didn't quite know what I was doing, but what I found was that it was possible to write about my own working class experience, and that was really important to me when I started out writing. Really, really critical. Then that really got, and Ian Macmillan was a he came to the school where I was teaching, and he said, send me some poems. And I did. He sent these good. Send them to a magazine. I didn't even know what a poetry magazine was. He was just an English teacher. Poetry magazines.
Yeah.
And he was, in his work as well.
Yeah.
The way he accommodates his own experience, working class experience.
Yeah.
And transforms it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He does have a wonderful thing which he says about you. This idea of you as a Skelmersdale mystic. That's such a brilliant thing. I mean, it is. I sort of think that it's that leap you're looking for in poetry, when you can take something that could be quite ordinary and find, or it's that sort of unwrapping process. He uses those words as well. I mean, what do you think helps you towards being able to do that? I mean, are you spiritual or religious at all, or is there something else that you've cultivated that's helped you to sort of take the wrappers off?
Yeah, I've been meditating since I was 21. I learned TM then. I became a TM teacher. So I've been practicing transcendental meditation all that time.
Right.
A long time. So that is like part of what I do.
Do you think? Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely. I mean, I can't imagine not doing it, because I've done it all that time, you know.
Yeah.
So that is part of what I do. So although I think that informs my process, but I haven't unpacked that really. I don't see myself as being necessarily a spiritual writer, but that informs the writing.
Yeah.
It's like what attracted me to Zen was that you could do it and not have to think about it the whole time.
Mm.
Like Zen Buddhism is a similar thing where you just get on with life.
Right.
And I love that. Mm. The fact that you can have that experience and then just get on with life. But I think it probably does inform what I do, but that kind of seeing into things. But I haven't. There's something that I'm not sure about analysing.
No, you know I know. It's a bit risky, isn't it?
Yeah. Let it happen. It's okay.
Yeah, that's right. So what we thought we'd have a do is have a look at a couple of poems a bit more closely. So which one should we do? Does anyone have a question in the meantime? Has anyone been burning to ask something? Should we do this, Alt St. Johann. So it's a bit. I wonder if we should read it again. I don't know, because I always feel like it's a shame in readings that you don't get a chance to hear the poem more than once.
Yes.
Yeah. Good. So let's read it again, and then I'm going to totally overanalyze it, trying to get you to do it.
Alt St. Johann. The children hide in the tree. They whisper and laugh. The branches move. These are the mountains, the trees on the mountains, the rocks. You walk and you walk, and forget that you walk. The child climbs out of the hedge, clutching a fistful of wheat, its roots thick with soil. Chew the husks, taste the sweetness. The cat sits on the cooker, gazes out on the valley, closes her eyes and opens them. You see only half of the moon, and mist comes out of the ground. The cherries are finished on the tree, the red currants ripe on the bush. We sleep at the top of the house, in the room full of musical instruments. The music enters our dreams and leaves by the gate, leaving it open. This, I decide, is paradise, where they lend you their shoes and they fit. It's easy to laugh, and the children walk forever, sleep through the night in the valley of stars, wake with the light, and remember.
Okay, so you said that the poem is you were on holiday and you mentioned being lent a pair of trainers that fit. So, but where did the poem begin, or why did you? What was the start? Was it a line or?
We were walking around in the Alps quite a lot, and I had a notebook with me, and I'd write things down all the time. So Ronnie, this friend of ours, is a singer, and she would sing to the children these beautiful songs. I couldn't understand them because they were in Swiss German, so I had to translate them, and she gave me a couple of lines, and it ended up in the poem.
Oh, right. Is that the middle bit?
The moon,
is that?
And mist comes out of the ground.
Ah, so
the lines
that's from right.
The song.
Yeah.
So I was writing things, and what happened was at the end of it was such a fantastic time, and I wanted to give them something. I wanted to give them a poem. So I got all these bits of paper, and I just wrote it then and gave it to them before we left. So
and
that's how that poem came
so
to be written.
So that's how it came to be written. But then did it change at all after that? Once you'd given it away, you didn't have it anymore. You must have kept a copy, did you?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
That's
yeah.
lucky.
Yeah.
So then you've got this poem. Did you change it at all after
that? That one, I don't think I changed.
No?
I don't think I hardly at all. I worked on it at the time because it had all these scraps, bits, notes, and I put it all together. I felt that works.
Yeah.
As though, yeah.
Oh, well, that's right. So what are the? Let me think.
Before you move on, can I just ask you what I felt the second time round? It's really useful to hear it second time round because I really didn't pick it up the first time. Is something like Elizabeth Bishop in this coming together of all these observations, and not just observations, but they're very concrete things actually. But they create a kind of a world in which you're almost looking like it, through a child's eyes at what's around.
Mm.
Is Elizabeth Bishop someone who's influenced you?
She's wonderful, isn't she? Mm. Fantastic, Elizabeth Bishop.
Do you see the...
I didn't see it until you mentioned it.
Yeah?
It's.
Yeah.
I find that a huge compliment, thank you.
You're welcome.
No, I really admire Elizabeth Bishop. I think she's a phenomenal writer. But that's interesting what you said about seeing things with the eye of a child, because there are children in that poem.
Well, it opens with the children, doesn't it? Which is
that's really very much part of that experience, and the poem is the way in which a child sees things. That's yes. So
yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, I think that is one of the things that really I liked about the poem at the beginning was the children hiding in the trees, because it's such a funny thought in a way. Of course, children always climb trees, but just a sort of upside down feeling from that makes me feel that things aren't going to be quite as they are somehow. But yeah, it is true, isn't it? And then the children with the wheat. Have you tasted wheat before?
Yeah, one of their boys, Casper, they could forage. They could probably live in the wilds. They were only 6 and 7.
Yeah,
and they could. They were far more fit than the we were. They were running up mountains and back, and
right.
And they knew everything about what was growing. So he went into a field, picked some, and he was eating it and gave it me to taste. So yeah, that comes from that.
Yeah. I mean, I did wonder if the children in the trees are different from the children that sleep. I think for me, the poem was divided into two halves. So I saw the first half as being these sort of wild children that live in the trees, and the second half being these children who live and sleep in. You know, at night under the, you know, and so.
Yeah.
But what about that lovely feeling of the music entering your dreams? That's such a lovely line. That spring into your head is such a lovely, lovely thing. I mean, music matters to you, it seems.
Yeah,
because it
really
comes,
important.
I mean, with the one we had before, Life Studies with Baker Street.
Yeah. Yeah, but music is really important, and there are lots of references to music.
Yeah.
And some of them are hidden in the poem, so you wouldn't necessarily know they were there.
Right.
Yeah.
And do you ever sort of feel that your audience should look up these poems and listen? I mean, do you ever worry a little bit about these?
Baker Street's a bit of a risk. When I wrote Life Studies, I thought, you know, I'm ending it with Baker Street, and I'm reading it to certain audiences, and they won't have heard Baker Street. So, but I thought, well, what the hell, you know, I'll just do it anyway.
You almost want to, because it's your opening poem, you could walk into Baker Street in a reading and then read.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then what about the title for the poem? Did that come very simply to you? I mean, it was The Place, so was why you
titles are really important.
Because I wondered whether it was a picture. I mean, that was what I thought. It's a thing that when I was reading it, I said, well, I wonder if this is a picture. And I did have the idea that it might be a medieval picture because it felt to me quite medieval because they're eating the husks.
There is a medieval history to The Place. And
is there?
St. Johann is John the Baptist. And there is a whole history there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's how that is in the poem.
Right. Yeah, so that... I mean, I suppose it is amazing, isn't it, that what you, when you do something, the things people make out of it, completely separate from... Because we were going to talk a bit about freedom, weren't we? And I was going to ask you about freedom as a poet. And one of the things I was going to ask is, you write a lot about family, and we've heard some of those poems. I was going to ask whether you feel any kind of constraint when you write about family or write about these things. And I was interested.
It's a big question. There are things that I feel unable to write about, that I would like to be able to write about in a way, but I know I probably won't. But it's interesting that, because you never know how your experience is going to end up in the poems.
Mm.
So it's like, sometimes things in your life find their way into the poem and they're transformed. So you find yourself writing about something that's important to you through the poem, in a way that you didn't anticipate doing.
Mm.
And that would be really hard to unravel, I think, for a reader reading it from the book.
Yeah.
But and not necessarily important for them to be able to do that.
Right.
I think whatever it is, it's like, I say this when I'm teaching writing, it's like everything you do, all the experience you've had, go into everything that you do. So if I wrote a poem in 5 minutes, and some of them I can write quickly, not necessarily 5 minutes, to be honest. I'm not that. But it's like, in a way, it took all those years to get to do that, you know? And it's like, that's how it comes. And sometimes you can get away. It's like when you do something a lot, so you become more adept at it, don't you? So you watch. My dad was a carpenter and joiner, and I used to work alongside him when he was working. And the way he used his tools, it was completely effortless. It looked as though he was... You know, not putting any effort into it at all. There's a real fluency about it. And I would hope that you achieve something like that in writing as well, that you're making something and all these things are happening without you necessarily knowing exactly how they fit together.
Mm.
It's both a very, very deliberate and a very, very undeliberate thing.
Do you feel very free as a writer then? Is there anything you think would be a no-go area, or do you feel that you're, because of that, as you say, that sort of percolation process that's happened and is always happening, that the writing is separates then, that's the freedom that you don't want?
Yeah, I write about anything, and I've got the books. I mean, there were how many years was it? It was between the first two books, there were 10 years between Henry Slop and Franklin Stampton School, I think 6 years between these two collections. And that's a long time.
Yeah.
So I wrote a lot that...
that you leave out. So how do you decide what to leave out then?
I think it's knowing the ones that work, that you have a feeling about them.
Mm.
Ultimately, I've got a very good editor with Peter Sanson.
Yeah.
And I trust him. It's like one of the hardest things as a writer is having somebody you really trust, isn't it? It's those of you that write. It's having somebody that you can show your work to that you think, you can trust.
Yeah.
And Peter's extremely good, even though he doesn't necessarily write like I do.
No.
He can see what works. So that's the ultimate. But even as I'm writing, I'm thinking, I'll work on that one, I won't work on that one. So loads of decisions go into that process all the time.
Mm.
And I will work on some of them that I know have got life in them.
Mm.
And sometimes they at the beginning I overworked poems sometimes when I started out.
Yeah.
And I learned not to do that. It's a kind of a really delicate thing, really. But a lot of poems don't get in the books, don't get in magazines.
So it is interesting, that thing that happens when you write a poem, and as you're writing it, it feels really great, and then when you come back to it, it does seem to have lost the life in it a bit. Mm. We've got a whole workshop on that at the festival, but I mean, do you sort of recognise that, and do you have anything you do to sort of help you, if you care about the poem, because I guess there must be a sense where sometimes you just think, actually, I discard that, it's not going to go anywhere, but if you care about it, do you have any techniques you use to breathe the life back into it once you've done a sort of first write, or if you feel that it hasn't quite got where you need it to go, do you have anything you do?
I think I recognise an energy in something that's good. And energy is kind of an odd word to use, but I can't think of another. Tom Rayworth uses the word energy, and I can't really think of another word that does it that amount of justice. There's an energy in a good piece of writing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I recognise the energy in the good poems, and I know the energy is there. The hard thing sometimes, I'll write something, I think it's not necessarily good, and someone will read and say, that is really good, you've got to put that in the book. So,
right.
And so sometimes I don't always see it, because I think, you know, that is just about my family or something, so it's a personal poem, I'm not going to put that in.
Mm.
So that kind of censorship was taken. But now, with Jam, I let go of all that. I just thought, I'm just going to go for it. I'm not going to edit it in any way. In that sense, I was much more inclusive in the way I accommodated different types of writing.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. There's a sense. Oh, sorry. Go. Have you? Oh no. Yeah, please do. Or just jump in. Yeah. Please don't be polite. Yeah, don't be polite.
Do you find, like, when you write a poem that you reveal something to yourself that you didn't know before?
Yeah. Yeah, it happened to you when you write.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was the way you said
it. The way that I hear your poems, I just, yeah.
Yeah, you write to find out what you think in a way, don't you? You write into the unknown. You write into the unknown, and at the end of it...
Do they ever surprise you with where they go?
Yeah. That's the whole point. Surprise is really important. Surprise is like the essence of writing for me. It's like, when I was terrible at school. I got bored so easily because I was taught so badly. And I don't like being bored, and I like to be surprised by things. And with writing, it is about surprise. That's really important. I tell people that when you're surprised by what you write, that's when you know it's going well. That surprise is essential. Robert Frost had this saying, no surprise in the writer, no surprise in the reader.
Okay.
So if the writer is surprised by it, then that element comes through. So it's not about deliberately being surprising. It's about uncovering something which you didn't know was there.
Mm.
Yeah. Hopefully. When it's going well. But it doesn't always go well, does it?
what about humour? Do you ever set out to write because I do think it's really... the poems are beautiful, aren't they, in their humour? I think we all agree that. And so how do you do that, and do you set out to do it, or...?
I like humour, and I put things in that I find funny that people don't always find funny. Like that line in Lighthouse, everything's uncertain since you've set alight my record collection.
Yeah. People don't know if that's a tragedy or funny or not.
I've had people go, oh! And someone really, I remember getting quite traumatised by the idea of you. If you hurt me, I kill him. She said, you know, there's that kind of real anger about it. But it's kind of funny and also really, you don't quite know whether it's funny or not.
Yeah, it does seem that humour is a very risky element.
It really is a risky
poetry,
element, yeah.
It?
It's really interesting thing where people laugh and how people laugh.
Can I just point out that I didn't set a light?
Did you not? I totally thought you did.
Carry on now.
It's the ultimate thing, isn't it, that setting like your record collection, it's the ultimate terrible thing, really.
Oh, and I don't know, so writing books works.
Books?
Yeah, for me.
Would it, yeah.
Mine's going to be a record collection, me it'd be a book, sorry.
Yeah.
But I think it's where humour comes out of that uncomfortable area,
yes.
The discomfort
that
makes it.
It is, yeah. It is the discomfort.
The discomfort.
Yeah. Yeah, discomfort. Like, humour is very close to its opposite, isn't it? Really, you know, there's it comes out of that. I mean, the best humour is terribly sad at the same time, isn't it? But yeah, humour is really important.
Yeah, yeah. It's, I mean, it's lovely. I don't know if you all agree. In the snooker table poem, it's I did think that poem is it's the use of detail that really is wonderful in that too, because you sort of think, oh, I don't care about having a snooker table on my table, but there's so much detail in the build-up to the moment when you put it on your back, and then of course the quiver, I guess, is. It's the quiver
of arrows.
Yeah, and the idea of walking up the street. And that it reminds me of another poem which you didn't read, which I also think is it's a kind of love these ideas of leap poems that they're going and then they leap, which I think is something wonderful in poetry to be able to do, isn't it? And yet it doesn't feel forced or false, you know. We are coming to a close, but I wondered if you'd like to read the Glastonbury poem and tell us a bit about that before you do. And I'll just check if I didn't have any other burning questions to ask, and everyone else should do the same. So, yeah.
You want me to read that?
Yeah,
I do. Can I just ask, how long does it take you, beginning to end? Does it differ?
A poem.
Do you write them, put them aside, come back to them after a month?
Yeah, endlessly. The first poem I read out, is it for the second one, Tonight at Kidderminster, took years.
Yeah.
So I wrote it, I wrote the first part, and then I didn't know, I was stuck on put the record on I was going to be a Rolling Stones song. And my wife actually talked about these two pieces of music she was at the time, and we talked about it, and those came into it. And the poem, we were broke, and I absolutely broke, and I said, I went to this poetry competition, if it wins, I'll buy you a new mixer. And my wife said, oh yeah. And it came, I won £100 with that poem. And then I had sent it off to the North, Peter Sanson, to publish in the North, thinking, yeah, he's going to publish this, it just won me £200, good poetry competition. And he said, no, it's not ready yet. I was so fed up. But I knew he was right.
How do you know when
it's really hard, isn't it?
That it takes time sometimes, doesn't it? You just have to leave it.
Yeah, it does. It takes time. That one, he was right, it wasn't quite ready. But there are alterations to it even now. There are things crossed out on it. And I'm always altering that one. That one, for example. But other ones were set, like the one at the budgie in the fire. I tried to alter that, but I can't anymore, because it's set. You know, once you've written something, sometimes it's set and you can't alter it without it falling apart again. I don't want to fall apart, because I like it.
So once it's published, you don't feel like it's finished. You might
evolve
it a bit further.
Yeah, when this was published, I was
thinking... Publish it a little bit later.
Yes, there are different versions of Life Studies, for example. There are three different versions published. There's one in here, there's one in a pamphlet, and there's one that was published in PN Review. And they're all different, which I quite like, really. No one will ever notice that, actually.
Well, we was nice here in the Kevin poems that are... Obviously, there's some in the earlier book, as you said, and that's going to be an enduring fascination, is it? Why is that, or is it the water?
I think the idea of breathing underwater is fascinating, isn't it? It's so interesting. It's like that. It's part of our culture, isn't it? Like mermaids and the skelly, isn't it? It's called a skelly, that creature that lives underwater.
Selkie, that's the one, isn't it? And it's sort of impossible relationships too, isn't it? That it's a wonderful way to talk about how impossible it is sometimes to be married to anybody.
that's right. But it's about also that I think part of it could be about being an outsider, feeling completely out of it, which we all feel.
Shallow water.
And we all feel that. So don't you feel that? You know, what are we doing? What are we doing here? It's such a weird reality that we have. It's kind of the whole construct of the way we live day to day. It seems such an arbitrary thing sometimes, and you think, why does it have to be? And I think maybe the Kevin poem's a way of exploring that, because I really got into this character Kevin. A whole sequence in which he got out of water, and the scientists were coming for him in the early version. We had three heads, by the way, in those versions, and he got Harley Davidson, and the last. He was about to ride into the Atlantic on the Harley Davidson, heading for the New World, you know, for the USA. and he had to put himself in bathfuls of salt water so he could learn to breathe under the ocean. And I got kind of obsessed with this character. Yeah.
I think that's what it comes out in this poem a little bit that you're going to read as well. It's a sort of total affection for people that get carried away by their enthusiasms. And that's lovely to sort of see celebrated in poetry, I think. And often it seems to me you do it with quite simply, but through hear it. It is that, isn't it? It's not grand things that the people in your poems are doing, but they often seem like people that just have enthusiasms that they're really going to follow through with, in a way.
It's the ordinary, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like Travis Perkins, for example.
Yes.
Yeah, that's really important. People have said that something about my poems, that's what they've seen. I think that's probably what it is. But I'm not conscious of it. It's just the way things are. Because that's in a way that's all we've got, isn't it?
Mm.
And so there is something quite miraculous about,
yeah,
about that. And like, you know, Vermeer's paintings, for example. You know, yeah. Yeah. Do you want me to read this poem? Glastonbury.
Glastonbury.
On a bench outside the Crown, a man takes a photo of his pint. The flash lights up the street, lights up the smell of weed, downwind from burns the bread. And in the Galatea, the waiter gives me a knife and fork for my soup instead of a spoon. As the child says, I know the biggest planet, what's the furthest one called? Her father demonstrates with the sugar bowl, plates, two chairs. He grabs a table, backs it out of the door, cutlery clatters on the pavement, and above the car park, the silhouette of the abbey, the moon behind cloud, the invisible scaffolding.
That one almost we'd have to have again and again, wouldn't we, I think, and say it is a really, really lovely poem. We're just about on time. Does anyone have any other questions they'd like to ask? I was going to just quickly press you a little bit on whether you feel you've moved away from the idea of political poems or writing about working, you know, this working person poems.
I see writing as a political act.
Do you?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, the whole thing. I mean, you know, I was a working class background. I found my 11 plus secondary mum. I was discarded, you know.
Yeah.
I went to a printing factory. I was so angry, and there was so, and to be able to write about that was incredibly liberating. And it's like, I feel as though I had to fight for everything. You know, it took me, I had to really work. There weren't workshops in those days.
No.
There weren't workshops.
No.
And, and there wasn't the support that writers get now.
No.
So I had to really work, really fight for it. So for me, just getting another book out is, yes. But and in other ways as well, I think writing it is political, you know. It's a giving of voice. It's that thing, and the ordinary, you know, the importance of the ordinary.
Yeah,
yeah, especially the way things are these days. I mean,
so, do you think you would ever think about writing a sort of deliberately political poem, or do you think it is just the act of writing that is?
There are poems that have a political edge. And there's one in there that was published in what's that?
Morning Star,
thank you, person in the audience. The Morning Star, for example, which has more of a more obvious political edge.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't write something which is didactic,
no,
in a sense. But I see political things in the poems that are there. I guess particularly in Henry's Clarke, it's more overt. Because I was writing about that background, that working class background, how important that was.
Yeah. Mm. Well, I think we've finished there, yes? Everyone, well, thank you very much, Cliff.
Thank you.
That's really lovely. And
thank you very much.